listening to the Defenestrate Media Network.
It's Roast with J.M. Bell and Tom. They're your Roastmasters.
I like light banter.
And we start in 3, 2.
Oh, the light banter.
I'm ready for light banter now.
Yes. I need some hand sanitizer.
Well, that's just because we talked about Scott Baio.
Yeah. Oh man.
I need more. It. You know, when Henry Winkler will always be cooler than you. No matter what part he's playing or how old he gets. Did you catch the show he did with Shatner, George Foreman, and Terry Bradshaw?
Holy God, what the hell was that?
It was the four of them on vacation for 2 months touring Asia.
Oh, what is it? It's called like the last foot of the grave or the last thing bucket list or something.
Hold on. Let's see. Winkler, Shatner, Foreman, Bradshaw. Better Late Than Never.
Yeah, that's right. Better Late Than Never.
And not only was it wonderful.
Oh, really?
They're going to do another season. Look, I have made no secret about the fact that William Shatner is my spirit animal. And that I hope someday to live at least as long as he has at the point that we record this. And while I know I will never be that famous, you know, I hope that there are people that appreciate my insane sense of humor. Now, add to that, I used to go to this barbershop when I was a kid that my dad took me to called Calhoun's. Calhoun's. And Calhoun's barbershop had all of the, you know, the regular barbershoppy stuff that you're used to. But, you know, it also had tonics and other things to put on your hair. And Terry Bradshaw used to shill for a hair growth tonic that you would put on your hair, which, as you could see, it was total bullshit because he never stopped balding. But
it didn't work for me.
Yeah, and so
it worked for you, but not for me. I'm doing this for you. It may not work for me, but it's going to work for you. I swear it will.
Still,
see, it's just like this is my thing.
It was called New Man.
New hyphen man?
I don't know. But yeah, it's Terry Bradshaw says, "Sometimes I don't care how I look. Sometimes I do." 1979's advertiser for Terry's New Man hairstyle, or as the rest of the planet refers to it, a toupee. But he had in the barbershop, he had a video playing. Where he explained how New Man made him more virile and accessible to the ladies. Oh, yes. And I just remember that. That's what I remember about Terry Bradshaw, is the bald guy with all the money, you know, used to sell, apparently, toupees. I was misremembering. But and then George Foreman is funny to me because he named all his kids George Foreman.
Yes.
That's just so fucking nuts. I can't stand it.
Those poor kids.
I know.
And he's got a grill.
Yeah. Look, I always liked the grill. I just never liked that you couldn't pop the plates off to clean the grill.
No.
No.
That's a problem.
It was a problem. So.
And it's just angled so you can just take the grease. Okay, here's a shortcut for all you people who don't know this. It's just, it's angled so the grease will just roll off the grill. So
right. But that doesn't mean when you're making a grilled cheese that the stuff doesn't stick to it. That's all. And then sometimes the grease gets a little back and behind and you want to pull those things off. Like waffle irons where you can't take the cast iron part off.
No.
And so you're sitting there with a machine that plugs into the wall that you're not supposed to get wet, but you desperately need to wash. So that was my problem with that. And then apparently
there's no oil scrubber for that.
Right. Right.
There's nothing.
Don't get it wet. That's all. It's a gremlin.
It's a gremlin.
But instead of making more of them, it just breaks.
It's a gremlin.
Yeah.
It's a gremlin, Phoebe Cates gremlin.
Yeah. Yeah. Sometimes I don't care how I look. Sometimes I do.
I didn't wear deodorant yesterday. I probably won't today. That's why I wear a Mitchum.
All right. I remember Mitchum. God damn.
So who's got the flip of the coin this week?
I can flip a coin right now. Why don't you call it? Hang on. Here we go. Call the ball.
With the president's head on it.
Yes.
Yes.
You want the heads.
Or Sacagawea.
It's, no, actually what I did was I flipped a 32 gig memory card because I don't have any money.
Branding side up.
It's, yeah, it hit. So we got heads, which means you, sir, can go first, and I will sit here and make smart-ass comments.
It's kind of funny because it's actually relevant to whatever it is that we do.
Cool.
And the reason why it is because I'll start out. It started out with a piece that's kind of been eating at me in it's Fast Co-Design, right? It's about, is design still relevant? It's a candid look at branding Clinton's failed campaign. Okay, so that the header was, for the first time, Pentagram partner Michael Beirut tells the full story behind designing for Hillary Clinton. And after Hillary Clinton revealed her campaign logo in 2015, everybody in media, politics, and design seemed to have an opinion on it, although one designer stayed silent. Michael Beirut is his name. He comes from an operation that's called Pentagram. If you know anything about the design world, the highly, you know, the bubble world of design world, there's a long history of American and international designers who have designed things, industrial design, cars, trucks, logos, identities, this kind of stuff. Pentagram specifically is a clot of designers, shall we say, partners, that have long pedigrees about some of the stuff that they have done. You know, some of the more recent things, maybe the DC Comics rebranding, you know.
Which one? The New 52 or Rebirth?
The DC Rebirth, the DC logo itself, DC Comics Rebirth.
It's not bad. The Rebirth stuff is not bad. The New 52 stuff drove me up a tree. That was, what, 5 years ago?
It's the kind of stuff when I was at a point in my career, I wasn't sure if I was going to be a designer or go into art direction for advertising. And there is a difference.
Yeah.
There is a specific specialization for that kind of thing. And that's fine. That's good. In fact, I don't even know if I'm any good anymore at branding and logos. But this is sort of the kind of stuff that we do. In late March, what happened was Beirut decided that he would break his silence, and he decided to write a really lengthy essay on the site Design Observer. So what I did is I have taken some of the points of this and cut out a lot of it, and then just, I don't know if I'm going to be able to go over, you know, hit it in 13 minutes. But it's fascinating for a whole bunch of reasons, Jeff. The biggest reason is that the candidateness by which Beirut talks about is how designers miscalculated the reality of this country. And so what happens is it states in this upfront, it offers rare personal insight into a very public, high-stakes project from one of the leading designers and thinkers in the field.
Let me do this, and this might help sum up.
Okay.
Did the designers that were working on the Clinton campaign, did they by any chance have anything to do with Pepsi and Kylie Jenner?
That's internal.
Because that seems to be...
The thing was internal. A lot of brands have an in-house branding and design and advertising.
They might have hired them.
And that all came internally. And if you're worth your salt as an agency, you would have been able to say to them, no, this is a really bad fucking idea. You should not do this. Yeah, but there was nobody there. Else maybe they just steamrolled over those people and didn't pay any attention to it. But no, that's a very good.
Having often been the guy saying, "Don't do this; it's dumb." They probably got steamrolled. The smart guy got steamrolled. So all right, but joke made. Carry on. My apologies.
Yeah, no, I think the thing about, you know, Pentagram and other operations like this is that there are bits and pieces. If you look at their work, it's stuff that you've seen. It's stuff that, you know, goes around. I mean, the only other, you know, thing I could say about them is they've did the rebranding for Verizon. You know, it could go on and on and on, and it just doesn't matter. This is the kind of thing that, you know, this is what 21st century design is. And there's something about this, though. There's something about this because it relates specifically to the disconnect between what it is that we do, that we think we do, and what really matters in the end. So he starts off with the observation in November, back November, a couple of months ago. You know, it was going to be the most thrilling night of my life, our life, all of our lives, as I walked the darkening streets of Midtown Manhattan toward the Jacob Javits Convention Center. From blocks away, I could glimpse an enormous image on the Jumbotron over its main entrance. A forward pointing arrow superimposed on the letter H. After an endless series of queues and checkpoints, I found myself about 50 feet from the venue's main stage. VIP credentials dangling from my neck. I was surrounded by a happy throng of people who, like me, were there for one thing: to celebrate the election of the first woman president of the United States. As if. I had never been to a political victory party before, and like everybody else, I knew that nothing was a sure thing. In fact, the previous weeks had brought more nail-biting revelations, abrupt reversals, capping off a grueling campaign that had been anything but easy, yet the mood in the crowd was optimistic, even giddy. Everyone claimed to have inside information, exit poll information from contested demographics, early vote totals from swing states, all of it adding up to a Hillary Clinton landslide. just not in the places we needed it. And everywhere I looked was that H logo. It was on badges, on buttons, on stickers, on t-shirts, and tote bags, on directional signs, and video monitors, and ablaze on a giant screen that hung high above the stage. Smock! It was on that stage that we expected to see our candidate before the night was over, arms raised in victory beneath an emblem that I had designed. The night had ended sooner than I thought, and differently than everyone had expected. Going home with my necktie, with its pattern of H logos loosened around my neck, embarrassed by my hubris and worried about the future of our nation, I tried to figure out what had gone wrong. Let's go back to January 2015. Almost 2 years before, he was invited to volunteer his services on a secret project. Wouldn't that be great to get that call? The design of a logo for the possible presidential bid of the former First Lady and Secretary of State, Hillary Rodham Clinton. I was excited. I'd never met her, but I liked her when she was my senator, and I was impressed with her performance as Secretary of State. I had assumed that she'd be the candidate in 2008, until Barack Obama had come along. 8 years later, she was even more qualified. This was a historic moment. I said yes immediately. I put together a three-person team. We would work in secret for the next 2 months. Our first meeting with the Clinton team began with a simple statement. Quote, our candidate has 100% name recognition. Now, there is a well-known marketing principle that is often credited to the mid-century design legend Raymond Loewy. If you go back and you Google up that name, you take a look at some of the industrial design that he did. Just set the stage for mid-century design. He felt that people were governed by two competing impulses, an attraction to the excitement of a new thing and a yearning for the comfort provided by what we already know. In response, Loewy had developed a reliable formula. It was something familiar. Make it surprising. If it was something surprising, make it familiar. So we faced the opposite problem. A candidate was universally known. How could we make her image seem fresh and compelling? Now, things had changed in the intervening years. For the Obama team, digital communications meant websites and email. Now the world was dominated by Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Voters had become accustomed to the broadcasting of their own voices, like our own, and making direct connections. To work in this environment, whatever we designed would have to be concise and efficient, capable of standing out on a tablet, a phone, or a wristwatch. All right. One more thing was different. In 2008, the Obama team had found themselves customizing their logo to appeal to different groups: veterans, teachers, the LGBT community. Now, looking back, some of these graphic adaptations seemed forced. within its concentric circles, its curves and gradations. The Obama mark was handsome, but it was complex. It already looked finished. I began thinking about a logo that was the opposite. Simple, open-ended, something that would invite participation. The Clinton team shared our ambition to create something new and different. And in the weeks that followed, that's what we tried to develop. The candidate had used traditional serif typography in her previous campaigns. We all agreed on a clean, bold, sans serif, that's block letters for the rest of us, which its designer, Lucas Sharp, agreed to customize and make available to the campaign for free. Barack Obama's favored all capitals. We recommended upper and lowercase. It's friendlier. It's more conversational. And although,
you know, okay, it.
Go ahead.
All right, I'm listening to these words, and already, you know, as a guy desperately clawing and trying to scrape a living in this market, I'm already seeing red flags flying. Mm-hmm. Everything that he's saying right now about they want to try to do and the reason that they want to do it makes no fucking sense. And he's probably got a scientific study somewhere to explain to him why suddenly it's like, hey, let's mellow it out. Let's calm it down. Let's chill it out. Now, I have another bit later when I am predicting this narrative goes, when they get to what it looked like. But this is how we fucked up Al Gore, man.
Yeah, this is how we fucked up Al Gore.
So it's the Donna Brazile effect is what it is. Okay, mm-hmm. Carry on. I apologize.
Brazilificate. We got Brazil'd. We had a Brazilian.
Rip! Ah!
Although the appearance and the approach to that, the approach is one thing, the appearance is another. And although we explored dozens of symbols, the one everyone agreed to and gravitated to was the simplest of all. A perfectly square H, but its simplicity was deceptive. What looked like an H was really a window capable of endless transformations. It could contain pictures and colors and patterns and motifs. Because so much communication for the campaign would happen digitally, the logo could change at a moment's notice. It could be customized not just by various interest groups, but by individual supporters. It was the ultimate dynamic identity system, or so they say. Still, we worried that the H alone, even as an ever-changing frame, was too static. We finally found what we thought was the right finishing touch, the simplest thing in the world, an arrow, and emerging naturally from the geometry of the letter form, pointing toward the forward toward the future.
Or, alternatively,
to the right,
the Twin Towers with an airplane about to fly into one of them.
Okay, now that's funny because it wasn't clever or artful. I didn't care about that. I wanted something that you didn't need a software tutorial to create, something as simple as a peace sign or a smiley face. I wanted a logo that a five-year-old could make with construction paper and kindergarten scissors. Finally, the time came to present the logo directly to Secretary Clinton. Now, I witnessed firsthand what so many called Hillary Clinton's greatest skill. She was one of the best listeners I've ever met. Walking into the meeting, I knew that a session with the logo designer had to be one of the most trivial subjects on her schedule that day, or maybe that week, yet she gave me her full attention, asked thoughtful questions, and despite her claims that she wasn't an art person, spotted a few weak points in our presentation I hoped that no one would notice. Even more surprising was the call I received the next day. Secretary Clinton thanked me warmly for our work, elaborated on a few points from the day before, and added some new thoughts. There was really no need for her to do this personally, but she did it anyway. She was brilliant. She was genuine. I never had the chance to evaluate a future president firsthand. I was sure the country would be in good hands. So, fast forward from there to April 2015. On Sunday afternoon, April 13th, 2015, Hillary Clinton officially announced her candidacy for president of the United States. It was an open secret by then that she was going to run. Every television news organization was standing by for the announcement, and I had not heard from the campaign in weeks. We'd completed our work more than a month before. I know there had been some internal controversy about whether our direction was the best and that other firms had been invited to contribute ideas. At times, I had reconciled myself to being dumped. Despite the candidate's initial enthusiasm, I would be disconcerted more than a year later when the exchanges debating the merits of our work showed up in all places, the midst of the vast trove of emails published by WikiLeaks. So, and Podesta's potato salad. Yes, the announcement came in the form of a two-minute video. It began with ordinary Americans talking about their plans, about making new starts. Then wearing a red and blue suit, the candidate appeared and said she too was starting something, her campaign for president. Finally, at the end, there it was. A skillful animation, the H built from the faces from the video, the arrow entering from the left, resolving in a red and blue version of a never-before-seen Hillary for America logo. The colors red and blue matched the candidate suits, or perhaps it was the other way around. It's we've been working on in secret, was suddenly public. It really happened. Then within minutes, the social media reviews began coming in. So what lucky third grader won the design of the Hillary Clinton campaign logo contest? Hillary's logo was clearly designed in PowerPoint by a PowerPoint user. This is a deep insult for a graphic designer worth explaining, because I have worked – I actually have a point of contention regarding working in PowerPoint. It's one of the fucking shittiest apps, programs ever work in. It is fucking horrible. But I know people who are absolutely brilliant, are able to make it work and do fantastic, incredible multimedia presentations. PowerPoint, ladies and gentlemen. So
if you could design something impressive in PowerPoint, chances are you're either autistic or a super fucking genius. Because as much as we hate it as designers, as much as we hate it, it is industry standard. Like, I've used Keynote on the Mac, much preferable, but you can't run it. But you can run a PowerPoint presentation in Keynote.
I've seen amazing, amazing presentations.
Yeah.
So they also had, people said the logo reminded them of a sign for a hospital or the Cuban flag or in cases of swastikas or the destruction of the Twin Towers.
Oh, yeah. Just like you said. That was me.
The fact that the logo was really the only new thing of significance in the announcement video made it an irresistible target for pundits. The red arrow pointing right. What did that mean about the campaign strategy? Then followed the think pieces. The internet freaks out over Hillary Clinton's campaign logo. Design experts trash Hillary Clinton's new logo. What, everyone went nuts over Hillary Clinton's new logo. Okay? They just went, okay. So I'm sure if you've seen... Okay, here's an email from a writer from a prominent magazine. So I'm sure you've seen the Hillary logo hysteria, he wrote. I think it's a case where, and you may disagree, the internet is kind of getting it right. I think it's a train wreck. I was then asked to participate in an invitation-only contest to redesign my own logo.
Jesus.
I declined. So, yes, it was surreal. I had already designed several controversial projects in the age of instant Twitter reviews, but nothing prepared me for this. As New York Magazine said, basically, Hillary secretly gave America a Rorschach test, and the results are fucking terrifying.
Awesome! I love this guy!
After consulting with the campaign, we agreed to adopt a no-comment policy about the logo. Good idea.
Yeah.
I held my tongue. The country had bigger issues to deal with. No fucking shit. Despite and nonetheless, because I was the only designer in the world who didn't seem to have a public opinion about it, its authorship soon became common knowledge. Now, it isn't pleasant to have talk show hosts making fun of your work on national television, and there was something also gleefully vicious about it. It was just some simple geometry shapes and a couple of primary colors, yet it seemed to drive so many people fucking crazy. My wife Dorothy helped put things in perspective. First of all, her name was Dorothy. Maybe, she said, this isn't really all about your little logo, she said. Though it all, I was heartened by the resolve of the team at the Clinton campaign headquarters. They were confident in the work, and they told me they had no intention of abandoning it. And we all knew something the world didn't know, that the red and blue logo was just the start. the potential of the identity system wouldn't be revealed until a few weeks later, as the Supreme Court prepared to hear oral arguments in the Obergefell versus Hodges to determine the legality of same-sex marriage. On April 28th, the campaign changed the logo on all digital platforms to rainbow colors of the LGBT movement. As we'd hoped, the world noticed. The transformation opened the door to more and more versions of the H and arrow combination. It's kind of like becoming the Empire State Building of presidential campaign logos, said a writer at NPR's website. Changing the colors to celebrate any variety of milestones and holidays, from pink or breast cancer awareness to red, white, and blue for Memorial Day to pastel fades for Easter a month and a half later, the idea of this dynamic symbol has taken hold. It's official, declared Quartz. Hillary's logo is actually perfect. Yeah, Quartz. Jump ahead to July 2016, the moment to come at last. Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia. Hillary was to become the first woman candidate for the president of the United States. Much had happened since she had announced her candidacy 15 months before. So little of it foreseen. An unexpectedly hard primary fight, the emergence of the unlikeliest of Republican opponents. A former colleague, Jennifer Keenan, was appointed Hillary for America's full-time design director and built an extraordinary team that worked tirelessly to ensure that the campaign's message was being communicated consistently and creatively on every available channel. Microsites, videos, GIFs, hashtags. I said GIFs. I didn't say GIFs. I said GIFs. The grassroots slogan, hashtag I'm with her, with the now familiar logo serving as the H, was ubiquitous. And the design team's powers were on full display in Philadelphia. Minute by minute, night after night, the H plus logo, H plus arrow logo was everywhere. Every sign in the convention hall bore the campaign's signature typeface. Perfectly sized, perfectly spaced, as only an obsessive graphic designer would, and noted with satisfaction the placards that greeted Bernie Sanders in Philadelphia the night he rose to call for unity on behalf of the party's candidate. His graphics had almost been random during his grassroots campaign. That night, Sanders faced a sea of signs bearing his name, not in Clarendon, the closest thing to a standard his team had managed to achieve, but in Unity, the Clinton font, in a concession to his staying power, a silhouette of a bird topped the lowercase. Like everything else, it felt perfect. As the campaign moved into its breathless final weeks, Hillary supporters took her graphic identity as their own. The simple geometry of the H-plus arrow was reproduced in thousands of forms, arrayed in patterns of seashells and the beach on Labor Day, carved into pumpkins on Halloween, stacked in beer kegs in Milwaukee, embedded in the state's name in Ohio. The underground army of supporters, who called themselves Pantsuit Nation, made the logo their own. Voters posted every possible rendition online, hand-drawn, crocheted, scrapbooked, appliqued. My favorites were the ones from kids. It turned out the critics were right. Your five-year-old could do this logo. And then there was Donald Trump. Bad typography, amateurish design, haphazard, inconsistent, downright ugly communications. When the Trump hyphen, or shall I say slash Pence, monogram was mocked for it, how did they miss that salaciousness where the T went into the P? And a bunch of people started doing animated GIFs where the T was fucking the P, okay? Their campaign team committed the ultimate act of weakness. They blinked, they took it down without comment. The Republican convention was a gruesome and tawdry spectacle, and everything was topped off with nothing more than a red hat with a badly kerned, caps-locked slogan. Later, Michael Moore pointed out that where he came from, the industrial Midwest, people didn't care about polling data or carefully calibrated social media campaigns, but they did wear baseball caps. He saw it coming. I did not.
I did.
Yeah,
I did.
You saw it. You had the vision.
there are, look, you know me. I am a serious font fetishist, right? I like all caps.
You're really good. I mean, what we do is pretty much the same thing. Yet you're like, you're writer designer, and I'm art director designer. Is that right?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that works.
You're one of the few that I know who's actually a writer, who is really good as an art director as well.
That's all about balance. But the thing is, it's knowing your audience and designing for the target. And one of the problems I had with the Hillary Clinton design was that complete, you know, it was a square.
Mm-hmm.
It was a square, and it was a concept. It was a brilliant concept. Make no mistake, that piece of art was well thought out. It was well put together. It was well engineered, and it worked for what they used it for. The problem is, there was nothing about that made it attractive to anybody that didn't spend a little bit of time being able to think mildly complex thoughts. 2 + 2 + 2 thoughts, right? And that's not me insulting Middle America. That's me saying Middle America is really fucking busy watching their, you know, dipshit reality TV reruns to appreciate the basically the blacksmith puzzle that you guys put together for that logo. And I am one that believes that when you put graphics together properly for politics, that it conveys the message that whoever the candidate is has their shit together, understands who they're talking to, what their problems are, and how they can help, right? The thing with the Hillary logo was, and her subsequent stuff that her team put out, it was too smart. And
it's too industrial.
Both that and they were thinky pieces. People just want to know Everything's going to be okay. And so that's how a guy like Trump ends up in office, is by saying flat fucking out, hey, everything's going to be okay, and I'm the guy that's going to give it to you. And you know, enough people got together and went, well, okay, that is what I want to hear, and did it. You know, it is the voting equivalent of battered spouse syndrome. You know, I'm sorry, baby, I won't do that again. Okay, I believe you. You know, for the 40th time. So, I listened to the words this guy's written down. He's very smart, and he's absolutely right. It was a very well put together yada yada. It just had nothing whatsoever to do with, you know, talking to voters.
No, it missed them completely. And his next entry, the final entry here, is in January, goes back January this year, and confesses the hubris in many ways. Going to design school is about surrounding yourself with a beautifully crafted bubble. Okay, Art Center College of Design, Pratt. Creative circus if you're in advertising, if you got money for that, mom and dad are, you know, forward you some money and you're going to go to someplace that's a beautifully crafted bubble. At least it was for me. Most normal people don't know or care about custom typography. The fine distinct, you know, you see, because everybody is like into Etsy and curated shit and how, you know, handcrafted everything is. I think that there is probably those who are, but we're not talking to them. Okay? The fine distinction between nearly identical colors, dynamic graphic identity, any of that stuff. Growing up in the Rust Belt, I grew up in the Rust Belt, just like Michael Moore, well, him. I certainly didn't. With each class assignment, with each studio critique, I became more skilled as a designer. And I became further from normal. Moving to New York put me at the center of a highly specialized profession, practicing what could have seemed to my friends in Ohio like a hopelessly esoteric brand of black magic. And I certainly feel that way too every single time I wave among the flotsam and jetsam. As we worked on the campaign, it never occurred to us to be anything less than perfect. As our campaign contact observed much later, to be imperfect would have been inauthentic to our detail-obsessed candidate. During the height of the primary battle, Lindsay Bellant, a Bernie Sanders supporter, wrote a perceptive critique, compared the graphics of the two campaigns. While Hillary's visual campaign is inarguably successful by all traditional design principles, it's also calculated, expected, and contrived, Bellant wrote. She also went in and said, it reinforces the perception of establishment status, which is one of the main criticisms of her as a candidate. One of the consequences of a design so tightly controlled is the campaign feels so tightly controlled. In contrast, the design of the Sanders campaign had the homespun charm one associates with a do-it-yourself craft site like Etsy. They looked and felt authentic. When I read this in the spring of 2016, I had to admit she was on something. On the other hand, Donald Trump's graphics were easy to dismiss. They combined the design sensibility of the Home Shopping Network with the tone of a Nigerian scam email. Like so many other complacent Democrats, my only question was, why is this even close? Armies of smart people generated oceans of words in the aftermath of the election trying to figure out what happened. Talented pundits and strategists and pollsters, all masters of their craft, were racked with self-doubt. I too wondered if the very thing that I was so good at had somehow betrayed me. We had spent months developing a logo. Trump had spent years building a brand. Had Trump won? Not in spite of his terrible design work, but because of it. So the day of Trump's inauguration, I was on an Amtrak train to Washington, D.C. Dorothy, my wife, had made plans to attend the Women's March just as soon as she heard about it. The car we were in was almost all women, and everywhere we looked, we could see pink, the knitted hats with the cat ears that would become the defining image of the march. The next day, we found ourselves in a crowd that seemed to stretch for miles in every direction. A forest of homemade signs became a display of wit, imagination, and passion that instantly went viral on social media. None of them matched, and all of them were beautiful. There was only one element of consistency. Those homemade pussy hats, which began as a three-woman project in a Los Angeles knitting class and became a national cottage industry that produced more than 100,000 hats in a matter of weeks, were so ubiquitous that they turned every photograph of the throng into a sea of pink. There was no guidelines, manual. There were no design directions. Instead, here was something thrilling, individual creativity in the service of collective solidarity. I still believe in Hillary Clinton. I am prouder than ever of the work that we did for the campaign. In that vast crowd in Washington, I wore the same blue-on-blue H-plus arrow button I did on election night. I knew how to do something, and I was good at it. But that day, I realized I was just one voice among many. The future will not depend only on experts drawing the battle lines, but on the courage and the enthusiasm of that each of us can bring to the fight. One last graph. We are in uncharted territory now, and it is at once frightening and exhilarating. Frightening because we face extraordinary challenges. Exhilarating because I believe more than ever in the power of design. It can provide comfort in the face of devastating change, and it can shake us out of our complacency when action is demanded. And now more than ever, at the moment we need it most, it belongs to all of us. And that was from Michael Beirut in Design Observer, called I'm With Her, about the post-election aftermath. And did I miss it? Go.
Okay. Well, I mean, let me save some for lessons learned later at the end, but
yeah, lessons.
There's an amount of insane hubris in that essay that I am guilty of constantly. You know, design will kill you. Bad design will kill you. But what's tricky about this is that it was a case of good solid design theory versus somebody made this shit in Microsoft Word. You know. Mm-hmm. So that's when you get to, did the logo lose the election? Fuck no. No, it didn't.
No.
The message did. But the logo became the personification of the message. And the message was basically, I'm smarter than you. Trust me. Nobody likes that. So.
Oh.
Well, that was good.
Wow.
That was good.
And so with that, we'll hit the break. And on the other end, Jeff, you, what do you have in the tease?
We're going to talk about Mandela.
All right.
But it's not what you think.
It only takes a minute to find out if you may have prediabetes. And you can do it at doihaveprediabetes.org. But you're probably not going to, are you? Kids, work, listening to the radio. You're busy, which is great because busy people can't get prediabetes. Oh my, I read that wrong. They can. Should have worn my glasses. So visit doihaveprediabetes.org and take a short test because prediabetes can be reversed.
Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
Hey folks, Jeff here.
And JC here.
Oh, and Taylor.
I want to talk to you about Patreon. Patreon is how, for the most part, we are paying the bills around here.
Come on, help us pay some bills.
It's important. These shows cost money to both make and distribute, and we don't ask for money very often. And what we're asking for here is you, as a listener, pitching in $5, $10 a month, you know, over the course of the year to help us grow and get bigger. We need it now. More than ever.
But look, you're not just throwing us money. We're going to give you something really unique for your money. Normally, everything you get from us is free. You get a free download of our podcast, The Left Show, the world's greatest podcast, comic book podcast, and of course...
The truck stop visits.
Yeah, the truck stop visits and Geek Therapist. And instead, we're going to give you exclusive content, stuff that we record separately that is then put out for only you to listen to.
Yeah, and I don't have dollar restrictions on that stuff. You pitch in $5 a month, you pitch in $25 a month, that's it. There are goals there if you do throw in a little bit extra. We send you presents as soon as I can find them.
Yeah.
And for those of you that are waiting for presents, I just need to find the boxes. Don't worry about it. But no, with Geek Therapist, the world's greatest comic book podcast, and of course this, The Left Show, and our exclusive content, you get more as a Patreon member of our family than you do anywhere else. So go to the website for your favorite of the Defend Media families, whether that be theleftshow.com, worldsgreatestpodcast.com, or geektherapist.com. Click on the Patreon button, become a part of the family, and start getting the cool shit nobody else is getting.
You know you want it. You know you do.
Just do it.
There are 10 jillion podcasts in this crazy world, but there is only one that serves a fresh pot of, hi, how do you do? I'm Tom, your host of the Coffee Cast. My mission is to make it as compelling a listen as you'll find it. I'll talk about all kinds of subjects. Sometimes I'll have guests. Good stories, because people listen to what interests them. And sometimes it's the Coffee Cast. So if you're listening as you're texting the seventh draft of a resignation message to that soon-to-be former psychopathic boss, gift shopping rotary phones for your great-great aunt, or skydiving for the first time without a parachute, whoops, welcome to the Coffee Cast. Remember, you can download a fresh Coffee Cast podcast anytime at Stitcher and iTunes, and now on demand on the Progressive Voices app and progressivevoices.com. So until the next pod gets brewed, I'll do my best to keep it fresh. The Coffee Cast podcast.
You haven't, like, played any applause things or sounders or nothing this week. It's weird.
No, I haven't.
You're a very serious fella this week.
I'm focused on delivering the goods rather than having, you know, weak, you know, plywood props.
I got you.
Keep hold me up.
All right, brother. Let us jump into the Wayback Machine, German. Set the dial for 9 December 1949. Wrong show. Of course, this is when I cough. French physicist Louis de Broglie, I'm pretty sure I said that correctly, is the guy who first put forth the proposal to create a European laboratory at the European Cultural Conference, which opened in a French city name, Lausanne. Fuck if I know. 9 December 1949. At the fifth UNESCO conference held in Florence in June 1950, American physicist and Nobel laureate Isidore Rabi tabled a resolution authorizing UNESCO to assist and encourage formation of regional research laboratories in order to increase international scientific collaboration. Now, for those of you that don't pay attention to that sort of thing, tabling means they told everybody to sit down, shut up. Right? Mm-hmm. That's what it means.
Yes.
However, yes. as things happened, an intergovernmental meeting of UNESCO in Paris, December 1951, apparently the American guy, Raoul or whatever fuck his name was, it wasn't there. So they went ahead and moved forward on it. Isidore Rabi. The first resolution concerning establishment of European Council for Nuclear Research was adopted 2 months later. CERN. We have CERN.
Right.
Okay. CERN's a big deal. Okay. They built it out in Switzerland under the eyes of Geneva officials. And it began what should have been an insanely important international scientific collaboration that off and on has fallen short of its mark, and it is not the fault of CERN. So let's jump forward. Okay. We are in Reagan's America, right? And somewhere down there in Texas, there's a bunch of folk down there with a bunch of really flat land out in the West Texas, right? They wanted to build a superconducting super collider. They were looking for what we now know as the Higgs particle, right?
The Higgs boson particle.
Yeah. We basically won the right to do that. Peter Higgs did. And because he had an idea that we could use that to study. Now, this is where we started getting me way out of my element, but I'm going somewhere with this. to study the birth of our existence as a universe. The superconducting super collider would have been out in Texas, would have boasted energy 20 times larger than any accelerator ever constructed, right? And it was there to reveal whatever surprises lay beyond the Higgs, allowing the United States to retain dominance in high energy physics. Because up until that point, America, son, that was where it was at. So 20 years ago, give or take, 1993, Congress killed the project, funding for the project. This would be Newt Gingrich's Congress.
93. Right?
In 93, October 21st of 93. So what, 25 years ago, almost? 24
October,
years ago?
Well, actually, the 104th didn't come in until, 93.
Yeah, they came in January of 93.
No, he had Congress until 94. He lost it in 94. That's when the 104th came.
Right. That's when, what's his name, took over.
Gingrich, asshole.
Yeah. Who was Gingrich. 93?
But they killed it anyway.
Well, no, because the election was in 92. So January of 93, the Republicans would have taken over.
He had a Democratic House, and I think he had a Democratic Senate until 94. And that's when the Republican House and Senate took over after that.
Gotcha. So, all right. You have this gigantic question mark with a big fat, I mean, really, when you compare what we've spent in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's not a big a deal. But at the time, felt huge and expensive. And so the American government killed it. And the truth is, I don't care if it was Democrats or Republicans. What it was chicken shit politicians that killed the superconducting super collider. Right? So
yes.
Flip back to Europe, and we get to CERN. And CERN has built their large collider, which, as you can see, as it has gone back to Europe, now has a boring name. The Large Collider. Oh, I wonder if it's big.
And sometimes known as the Hadron Large Collider.
Yeah. boring. Superconducting super collider. That sounds like something Superman would throw at somebody. Right? Because Americans,
yes,
we may be a little fucked up, but we know how to name shit. The green or the Blue Skies Initiative.
Oh, the Blue Skies. Oh, great.
The Patriot Act. So, all right. So here's a couple of bits about CERN's large collider. It is the biggest machine in the world. The biggest machine in the world. Cost $9 billion to make, which I believe is what we've spent since the beginning of this show, still in Iraq. It's 575 feet deep. That's 175 meters because they did build it in Europe. 17 mile long. And it's awesome.
You're welcome.
It's so pretty. It is. The CERN collider is composed of 9,600 supermagnets. Supermagnets. See how cool this would have been? And then they fire protons around a track, the big circle. And then they run them into each other. Right?
Yes.
You can get high temperature. Stephen Hawking really doesn't like the idea of it. He really doesn't. And this is where I start going, wait a sec. Who doesn't like it? That seems like something we should pay attention to.
Well, Hawking would be the man.
Yeah. He says the God particle found by CERN could destroy the universe. Catastrophic vacuum decay, which would cause space and time to collapse, and we would not have any warning of the dangers. Ask yourself, how much energy is keeping it together? Then if you put more than that energy into the object, it will explode, says Neil deGrasse Tyson. So just put a pin in that. It could open the door to other dimensions. It's a weird place to build.
Probably why Trump won.
Yeah. The deity of destruction is their corporate mascot. Have you noticed that?
The deity of destruction. I'm familiar with Prometheus and who? Shiva. Of course.
Yeah.
Oppenheimer.
Goddess of destruction. So there she is on it. All right. You know, just bits and pieces. Okay. So with this, we break down to those last things. Neil deGrasse Tyson and Stephen Hawking, two people that are way smarter than me, say that we're going to blow up the universe with fucking around with basically the building blocks of what caused the Big Bang. Now, when you say it like that, like a simple person like myself can understand it, you go, huh, that sounds dumb. Maybe we shouldn't autoplay with two bits that make up what blew up everything into everything.
These aren't crazy people. These are scientific people. This isn't like Dennis Hopper in Apocalypse Now going, you can't go into, you know, space with fractions, 5/8, 6/9, 7/16. You know what they're gonna say when he's dead, man, huh? He was a kind man, he was a wise man. Back to you.
Oh my god. Heineken, fuck
man.
That shit.
You know,
Pabst Blue
Ribbon. I'm just a skittering of feet on a dry pavement. Go on.
That's it. I don't want to go. Go where? Get a drink. Great idea. God, that fucking movie. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you're doing pop culture wrong.
No, yes.
So the Mandela effect. See, I told you we'd get to Mandela. The Mandela effect is the observed phenomenon of people having clear memories of events that did not occur or misremembering significant events and facts. A term was coined in reference to events that large numbers of people around the world share false memories, but it's also generalized, refer to any incident of a false memory. Mandela effect is relevant to project management and human resources, as well as other areas of business. Common examples include clients that have memories of deliverables and requirements that the vendor never promised, and employees who complete assignments that bear no resemblance to what they were asked to do.
Like thousands of people, thousands of Muslims cheering in the streets during 9/11.
Right, which didn't happen. There's a lot of people crying. Nobody happy. People that thought they were happy people are probably really creepy in the head. So the phenomenon is named for Nelson Mandela, former president of South Africa. Many people mistakenly believed he died in prison in the 80s. And he was released from the prison in Fiona Brom. Well, I can't remember what year. I forgot. I didn't write it down. Oh, he was released in 1990.
90. Oh, okay, 90.
Right. So they think he died in the 80s. He got out in the 90s and became the president of South Africa. So a paranormal researcher coined the term in 2010 when she discovered at Dragon Con.
Dragon Con? No,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah, Science Fiction Gaming Con, for those of you that don't know. And if you're listening to this and you don't know, I still have to wonder how you got here. That a significant number of people shared her false memory of Mandela's death. Mandela, who was still alive back then, lived to be 95 and didn't die until 2013. Now, according to various theories, the Mandela effect is evidence of implanted memories or parallel universes. In psychology, the effect is explained by the human capacity for confabulation. Say that five times fast.
Confabulated.
Yep. The fabrication and distortion of memories, which may seem clear and detailed as events that actually happened, but in fact did not. So a couple of examples of the Mandela effect on people. Oscar Mayer is spelled wrong. Have you ever seen this one?
No.
Yeah. It's Oscar Mayer, O-S-C-A-R. My baloney has a second name. It's M-E-Y-E-R. Do you remember that with the song?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was in the agency. I didn't work on it. But thank God somebody else did.
Yeah.
Cool. He has a name.
But the baloney's second name is actually M-A-Y-E-R. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Right. People think the Monopoly man, Rich Uncle Pennybags, has a monocle, but he doesn't. The tip of Pikachu's tail is not black and never has been. My favorite was the Berenstain Bears. Right? And how somehow their name changed to the Berenstain. Right? So people recall that the books, known as the Berenstain Bears, but if you look now, they're called the Berenstain Bears, and many people insist they remember a spelling with an E, right?
Yes, unlike Caillou.
Right, yeah.
Right. Berenstain, I've got a Berenstain. It was a terrible memory. I just woke up, and there was a Berenstain.
Right. A lot of people claim to remember that Curious George had a tail, but he doesn't have a tail. So either it got changed or not. Darth Vader never said, Luke, I am your father. He said, I am your father. Okay. So there's a lot of this.
Isn't there one like Chick-fil-A?
No, it was whether or not Chick-fil-A was C-H-I-C or C-H-I-K. And it's C-H-I-C, like chic, fill A, right?
Right, right.
Right.
No one explored Chick-fil-A.
What did the evil queen in Snow White say to her looking glass that hung upon the wall?
Mirror, mirror on the wall.
Incorrect. She said magic mirror on the wall.
Holy shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. Jiffy peanut butter does not exist. It's Jif, and it always has been. But I remember Jiffy peanut butter. Don't you? Okay. So those are some cute examples of the Mandela effect I found online. It really is, because some of these I'm like, yeah, whatever, and some of them I'm like, holy shit. Now my favorite thing is that some people actually have, with the Berenstain Bears, they have the like books and tapes, and they say Berenstain, and now it's Berenstain, which I just gotta wonder what that's all about, right?
Right.
I don't understand that. So, okay, so we have that now. The super collider, right? We fired that off a few years ago, right?
Yes.
And we got our Higgs boson, and we're exploring the building blocks of what we use to blow ourselves into existence billions and billions of years ago, right?
Yes.
And the universe is a very complex thing that is, I am told to believe, and I will, that it started from less than nothing and became all that it is today. The universe is a true American dream story, Tom. Now,
yes.
A little article popped across my dashboard today on the Facebook about a very young genius named Max Lachlan. He's 13 years old. Okay. When he was 13 years old, he invented a free energy device, something that could potentially power the whole world for free. He became famous across the world for his brilliant ideas and points of view on interesting topics like the nature of the universe and alternate realities. But now he has a theory that CERN destroyed our universe and we are living in another one that was parallel and closest to it. He believes that the Mandela effect is a result of that, and that something strange happened a few years ago when we first fired that up that reset the laws of reality, such as they may or may not be, depending on which universe we're in. Now, I, as a comic book fan, have juggled in DC the multiverse.
Yes.
Right? And yes. In Marvel, the alternate universes.
And Family Guy, the multiverses.
Right. So we, quotes, live on Earth 616. In Marvel, which is the one that I like. In DC, we're a lot more cocky, and we live on Earth 1. We're number one. Okay, so this does not seem all that strange to me. But when you add that this young man, Max Lachlan, believes that something terrible happened, and now we are paying the karmatic consequences of having basically wiped out an entire universe full of at least 9 billion people, and who knows how many countless others, that bad shit's happening. And that as we have burst forth into this new reality, that things that once we took for granted cannot be taken for granted anymore. Such as folks saying shit like, oh, Donald Trump will never secure the nomination for the Republican candidate to be president of the United States.
Yes, of course.
Right? Now, yeah. I said, I think he can, and people really ought to be taking this a lot more seriously. Because apparently, as a comic book reader, and I just throw this out there, it is a hypothesis that I have yet to even try and prove, but as a comic book reader, I am, imaginarily speaking, able to twist myself into impossible scenarios by suspending disbelief and looking at something for what it is as opposed to what I want it to be. Because when I saw that narcissistic Cheeto riding down that escalator, I knew that that was a clear and present danger to everything I knew to be sane and rational. And I started saying so on the show in little bits and pieces, and I kept getting resistance from it. And so I got louder and louder, basically saying, you cannot blow this off as insane. When you look at what we as Americans consume as entertainment, let alone that we don't read anymore. And when we do, it's garbage for the most part.
Yes.
Don't get me wrong. There's some pretty good shit out there. But...
and cat videos.
Oh, Jesus. You know, dog videos, totally fine. Make no mistake. But
yes,
it would seem that CERN fulfilled the promise to a point of Stephen Hawking and Neil deGrasse Tyson and killed us all. And that in the habit, if you will, in the inertia of energy and the memory that energy sometimes has, we have popped into existence as a mild shift from where we were before. And Jeff Sessions is now our Attorney General. And
so we're stuck in this multiverse until the CERN runs again, and then we're shoved into another alternate universe where things are not, we'll never return back.
No, I don't see. Now that's the thing. And And this is where we kind of get into the weird. If I go back in time and kill my grandpa, what happens? But
yes,
I believe that I believe this is all bullshit, just so everybody knows I'm just fucking around. But I believe that by resetting or restarting or rebirthing, if you will, sir, the universe, okay, that we changed those slight laws of whether they be physics or something we do not yet understand to allow the large collider to work without killing us again, because we are already in the darkest timeline. See?
And we are witness to people expressing opinions like,
I gotta hand it to him though, sharks. I never saw that coming.
Sharknado. It happened.
All right, let's take a break. And we get back on the other side. We can talk about the lessons that we have learned today.
I am Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family. And then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
What do you miss when you miss The Left Show?
Huckabee, being a former pastor,
yeah,
and the biggest mouthpiece for the Christian right, has proven himself time and again to not be a Christian because he believes that Levitical law is absolute and was never removed by Christ.
Right. So he's a rabbi, yeah, and therefore not Christian.
Yeah, yes. He's Rabbi Huckabee.
Why not? Then he gets to eat better deli food.
Oh. Haven't the Jews been through enough?
Yeah.
Oh. That was a good point. Good point.
I am pretty sure.
We
got a little bit to go, but I am pretty sure Taylor just won the show.
Fresh episodes every Monday on iTunes, Stitcher, and theleftshow.com.
All right, so as we do, I will start because you started at the beginning.
Okay.
I am split in how I feel. What was his name? Brazil? No. What was his name?
Mandela?
No, your guy.
Brazil. Oh, Beirut.
Beirut. Michael. Brazil, Beirut, you know.
What's the difference?
It's all full of sadness. So.
It's all the same plane ride.
Sure, sure. And it doesn't exist anyway, because this all happened and then we blew it up. But right. Anyway, Mr. Beirut, as a guy who works all the different parts of a campaign, I know that what he's saying is completely fucking ludicrous. But as a guy who has worked all the different parts of a campaign, I know how important what he does is. And how he would seem to put too much weight on the importance of that and basically put himself in a survivor's guilt complex.
Mm.
That logo, despite everything I said while you were talking, because I do have strong feelings about it because of who I am and what I do, that logo did not lose that race. That logo, had it been attached to a message that was more inclusive and more tailored to the people that needed to hear something reassuring, that logo would have been one of the most ultimately brilliant pieces of design of the last century. But it wasn't. And it wasn't not because of the logo designers, who did put it together in a way where its utility was nearly infinite. But, you know, it was attached to... It was attached to people who had already drunk the Kool-Aid of a false foregone conclusion,
mm-hmm,
and ran accordingly. And while I don't blame Hillary Clinton per se, there were a lot of people, and this is why yes men are so dangerous, It's why I surround myself with people who can't stand me and are ready to stab me in the back. Because it makes you more nimble and you're able to think. Because even if you don't agree with everything everybody around you says, when that's all you hear, that's the bubble that you're in. And when you go back, and I've done it a couple of times now, and listen to some of her speeches, especially the debate, some of her answers at the debate, you could see how her answers are far superior to anything that fell like a diarrheal birth from the anus mouth of President Trump. I mean, he's babble. Have you read the AP article, this last interview of him?
It hurt my eyes. I saw when they called bullshit on some of the things that he deliberately.
I don't know how you call bullshit on something that is just basically a tossed word salad. There are no answers in there. How do you call bullshit on no answers? They're like, oh, it's full of lies. I'm like, how do you find a lie when there's no coherent thread of communication whatsoever? How the fuck has he ever done anything? Because I don't know how he gets from A to Z, you know, that he doesn't bring in numbers, letters, and just doodles with a pen and a crayon. So...
dressed with his own poop and says things like the AP wrote as unintelligible.
Yeah,
that was fantastic. That was devastating. I thought that really punctured the Zeppelin.
Well, it would if he understood what the fucking word meant, which he doesn't. So the lesson that I learned is that I am capable of jumping into a bubble and playing around inside it. I've done it before. I don't do it anymore. I don't oorah, I don't cheerlead anymore. I get in, I get the fucking work done. And I think that Mr. Beirut should take a step back, take a deep breath, realize that the work he did was solid and good, right? Even though a few of his suppositions were completely fucking wrong. Lowercase, Jesus Christ, thin fonts, fuck you.
Jesus,
amateur.
Who fucking care? Yeah, I know. This is the things we're supposed to care about, but right. Care on, go on.
You know, and just this, it's not your fault, kid. It's not. You didn't do anything wrong as far as the winning or losing of an election goes. Your belief that thin fonts are good and that all caps are bad is horseshit. But that's because I work in politics and have for years now, and you made a pretty logo. So I get where you're coming from. And if there was one thing that came out of that article that I absolutely completely fucking agreed with, it was how insanely weird, random, and unbrandable the supporters of Bernie Sanders were by just making shit they wanted to.
Yes.
You know.
Using Clarendon and the bird.
Yep.
Looking at and the silhouette of Bernie's head.
Oh, God, yeah. The favorite t-shirt around this house is the silhouette of his hair and glasses. The second favorite is Bernie as a Muppet, but that's not here or there. So how about you, sir? What did you learn this week?
I learned the thing. There's one word that haunts me, and the
placenta.
Hillary camp used the word. Well, actually, two words. Perfect storm. They say they faced, you know, they in the post-war analysis that the idea was that they faced a perfect storm. And to me, I can't square with that, because I think that in the end, you have to take ownership over what happened. There are things that happened. There are insurgent campaigns regarding no matter how ugly or horrible they were. You know, you think about Bush, Cheney, you know, Leave No Child Behind in like 2000. You take an insurgent campaign like Obama. And then you take an insurgent, just a blunt instrument like Trump, and just as a cudgel, using his linguistic, whatever you want to call it, his word salad, his bullshit, his fake promises, his fact that he had to be the first and the last word in everything. He had to already use a psychological jujitsu sort of being able to destabilize opponents and plowed through everybody in order to make it to the White House. You have to take responsibility that your eyes were not opened wide enough to see it and be able to work and be able to do something about that. It's almost as if you had two campaigns on two parallel tracks and people bought the Coke and the others bought the Pepsi. And to me, at some point, we'll be able to figure out a little bit more of this. But when you're the designer and you feel like you created something, you said it. It was just like it was too smart. It was too smart, and you were talking to other people. You didn't talk to the vast majority of people who are disenfranchised. The one thing that I hear constantly over and over about this election is that people chose to push back on progress. People chose to hurt other people deliberately because for some particular reason, they may be, I don't necessarily buy the economic distress. I think that people have been noshing and been poisoned by this political atmosphere, by this conservative media, and that they bought the narrative about somebody that they already knew for a long time, and they decided that fuck this, you know, this isn't going to do me any good. I'm going to go with that guy. I'm actually cool with the racism. I'm cool with the misogyny. I'm cool with everything else. That's not a deal breaker for me. I want to see these people fucked. Because they've been running the roost for like 8 years, and it hasn't gotten me anything. And so they took that blunt instrument, that red trucker hat, and this isn't necessarily coherent or really sharp or precise, but I felt as if this insurgent campaign was a blunt instrument that was used to deliberately erase and take things back because people too fucking terrified of progress in the future.
You just bummed me out, Tom. I mean, you just really, really bummed me out.
It's only 77,000 votes in 3 states.
I know. I know. Don't get me wrong.
We got all the votes. They're just not in the places we needed it.
The depression is there.
It hurts to fucking lose Florida, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. You know, I mean, Iowa is bad enough. I mean, the night Barack Obama in the primary won Iowa, I cried. I hadn't felt like that since like Bobby Kennedy. And the fucking fact that, you know, that this kind of change is possible, I still believe we can. But we just kind of fell into this track that hopefully with everybody focusing and resisting, we could be able to dethrone these fuckers.
Yeah. Well, we would be able to, but now we exist in an alternate timeline. We're all fucked. So, sorry, buddy. It's the Empire wins here.
That in this episode, Max Laughlin has warned us about it, but we didn't listen, and now we're fucked.
Just hoping somebody, maybe we do build a new superconducting super collider in Texas and that could put everything back the way it's supposed to go. So, with that said, sir, and with the longest episode of Roast yet recorded.
Ever.
Thank you, brother. Happy anniversary.
Thank you, sir. Oh, thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
I do. I saw a picture of your wife, and I don't get it, but she apparently does, sir. So that's great. Thanks, buddy. I will. I'm going to hit the pause button, and we will chat again next week.
Next time.
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, I totally forgot about this. Damn, where is it?
I don't know.
Okay. All right. It only means one thing. Yeah, that's the supposed to be the outro music. 30 seconds.
You can always email me that, and then I can just put it on.
Yeah, we can definitely do that. So until next time, ladies and gentlemen, remember, drive safely. Night, Jeff.
Don't suck all the fun out of my life, mister.
Won't get no supper tonight. A lot of people won't get no justice tonight. The battle